This is Talk of the Town on Magic 590 and 100.5. I'm Bob Cudmore. Joining us is Sarah Foss, news columnist for the Daily Gazette newspaper. A big story in the Schenectady area, the whole capital region, in fact, the whole country and the world, has been what the heck is going on with General Electric? You've written about that.
I did write about it. Yeah, I think that's everybody's question. You know, what's going on and what's the future? What's the future for this company, which has, you know, an enormous track record of success? And right now they're clearly, they're struggling. I don't think it can be denied that they're in an odd period in their history where, you know, they need to make some drastic changes to kind of recover, you know, recover the stature that they once had.
I once worked for GE.
Oh, yeah?
When they owned the radio station I worked for a time.
Sure.
And I mean, it was something, you know. And I remember getting some GE stock, which they kept splitting and so forth. So now I've got a lot of it, what I consider a lot of it, but it's fallen
price.
And since so many thousands of people in the Schenectady area have worked for GE and also participated in the stock, a lot of people around here own the stock.
Right. So they can see what's happening with their own eyes, you know. I mean, you don't have to be an employee or a administrator or executive there to understand what's happening. I mean, you might own the stock. You know people own the stock. I mean, I've been hearing people complain about the stock for years, I feel.
Right.
I mean, that's not new at all.
No.
So,
but worrying about jobs, I mean, there was this big, GE was much bigger, let's say, during World War II and right after, and shrunk quite a lot. But it's been fairly stable for some time. You know, I think employing about 4,000 people, something like that, which is a lot of people. Not what they used to employ,
right,
but a lot of people.
Right. Yeah, and I think I'm still trying to get a handle on what the restructuring they're doing might mean for this area. It's not clear that it's going to mean job losses, but I don't think we have a full handle on sort of long-term what that looks like.
Talking with Sarah Foss, news columnist for the Daily Gazette. You also wrote about a story that really has its focus in Albany, about the local aspect of it, about the Poor People's Campaign. This is a protest group, and they protest in Albany, where the state capital is. I mean, a lot of groups protest. But Mayor Kathy Sheehan, sent them a bill for $1,400 for blocking traffic on Central Avenue. And she was on the program a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, her argument is that they never ask for the permit from the city, and that she would, in fact, she seemed sympathetic to their cause, but she said she felt she had to find them, but I don't know. But you will. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, do you have to find them for not asking for a permit? I mean, I think, you know, Mark Mishler, who's a civil rights attorney in Albany, I mean, he's sort of made the case that, you know, exercising your First Amendment rights really doesn't require you to request a permit from, you know, from the city or the powers that be. I'm pretty sympathetic to that point of view. Logistically, I mean, I can see, you know, some perspective from the city where they might have liked to have some information from this particular group. I know their first action, which I didn't go to, was fairly disruptive in downtown Albany, you know, tying up the traffic and whatnot. You know, some of that's to be expected, and some of that people will just have to deal with. I mean, I don't know much about how Albany bills groups like this for police services when they do protests. And so, I mean, I guess I would have some curiosity about how that process works before I could just say, oh, well, it makes sense to bill the Poor People's Campaign. Mm. I mean, the thing that's so funny about it to me is just like sending the Poor People's Campaign a $1,400
yes.
bill. You know, it just sounds bad.
It's
almost like
good.
If they had a different name, people would be less inclined to wonder what was going on.
But you talked, I believe, or you went to maybe a demonstration or something. What can you tell us about the group? What is this group?
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to build upon the work Martin Luther King was doing when he was assassinated in 1968. So it's focused on, you know, ending poverty and some of the issues that kind of go along with that, like promoting the idea that everybody has a right to, you know, say, affordable housing, I mean, one of the things King was really focused on was an end to militarism. So he was very much against the Vietnam War. I think that's part of what this group is doing, but not as much a focal point as the poverty, income inequality, you know, those issues we hear about that, you know, some people have been left behind, and what can we do as a society to, you know, make their lives better and more and easier.
I believe they have a kind of a charismatic national leader, but you also found they had a local spokesperson who was really
eloquent.
Yeah,
well, I mean, nationally, they their leader is Reverend William Barber, who's gotten a fair amount of attention. I think he spoke at the Democratic National Convention and got a lot of attention there, but he's just sort of a charismatic figure that people are becoming more familiar with locally. And Barbara Smith has sort of been their spokesperson. She's a activist who served on the Albany Common Council, who, I mean, she's been involved in the activist circles for a long time. Mm-hmm. So she's a good, I mean, she's a smart person and smart about organizing.
You also did a column recently about drunken driving, referring to a case from 1999 where a man named Joe Klementowski from Hageman died when his car was hit by a drunken driver as Mr. Klementowski was coming home from a concert at SPAC, and he was 47 when he died. And what you found, and you wanted to follow up on it, was that his sister, a woman named Jean Carudis, who works, I believe, up at the Fulton Montgomery Community College, she speaks at... Is it that victim impact panels?
Yeah, it's victim impact panels where people who have been convicted of drunk driving offenses, they're often sent to these to listen to people like Jean who have lost a loved one to a drunk driving accident. And she tries to describe the, you know, terrible impact this has had on her life and what was lost that day when this drunk driver, you know, basically collided with her brother. The idea is that people will take something away from it, maybe, you know, maybe not drive the next time they're drunk. I mean, that's sort of the idea, to just give you a sense of what this type of behavior can result in. And she's been doing it for 18 years, which is a long time.
And I believe you wrote that she has found that at the beginning she was really angry.
Yeah, she was angry.
But now, how has it changed?
I just think over time, telling the story, and also she said, you know, she began to see people in the audience, you know, they would break down when she told her story. She could see that they were listening and they were upset by it. Sometimes they would come up to her and talk to her after her talk. And, you know, it led to this shift, I think, from just seeing them all as, she said, you know, potential murderers who could kill someone anytime they got behind the wheel, to, you know, human beings with problems. I mean, one thing she said, I don't think I included it, was a lot of them seem to be alcoholics. They're not just social drinkers who made a mistake. They're struggling with a real addiction. And I think she has developed some thoughts on, we need better addiction treatment services, that there's an addiction issue here that is complex and needs to be, you know, addressed in a substantial way. So she has some sympathy for the fact that they are, you know, addicted to alcohol, that it's not an easy thing to just not drink for them.
And she continues to do this.
I think sometimes she thinks about not doing it, that it is a bit emotionally wrenching. I mean, it's not easy to talk about this for her, but at the same time, I mean, she said it has helped her heal emotionally and that, you know, it's changed her life in some positive ways. That, you know, she used to do a different type of work entirely. I think she worked at a bank, and now she, you know, works with students at FMCC. She's just gone off on a more kind of direction really aimed at, you know, helping people.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You've written a recent column about a controversy in actually the town where I live, in Glenville, about a gun range which is proposed for the town police department in West Glenville. And you did note that Glenville's really, you know, not just because I live there, is a really interesting place. I mean, it's very suburban and quite commercial along the Route 50 stretch. But out in what they call West Glenville, and I don't really live in that part of Glendale. Right. It's very rural, right?
It's very rural. I mean, yeah, I think a lot of people have the idea of Glenville in their head as like a suburb with a lot of chain stores, and you get out to West Glenville and it's a little more wild. I mean, there's wildlife, it's hilly, a lot of trees, a lot of forest. I mean, it's really a beautiful area, you know, where they want to site this gun range. And it is rural. I mean, that's probably one reason the town thought it was an appropriate place to put it. It's not like a busy neighborhood with a lot of homes, you know.
And this would be a gun range for specifically for the Glenville Police. And you talked to Supervisor Chris Ketsley, who's been on this program not too long ago. And as I understand, well, the reasons they put the gun range there is, as you say, it's rural. Also, they own the land. And it's a former landfill, so they can't do much else with it.
They can't do much else with it, except maybe put some solar panels out there, which they may do anyway. So, you know, Chris Ketsley, the town supervisor, he's correct. I mean, it's properly zoned. It's a use that's approved for that site. You can't do much else with it. You couldn't put it even on the capped part of the landfill. It would have to go in that kind of shallow area that's not part of that capped area. So, I mean, from the town standpoint, it's like, well, this is a place to put it. We don't have a lot of other places that are just sitting there waiting for a use, basically. Yeah.
And the idea of why they need it, apparently when the police officers get their gun training, they get it at a... They might get it at a private shooting range. In fact, there's one near there.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble with that, says the supervisor, it's cost, because they can only go there when there's availability. And so he ends up paying some cops overtime to train. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's what Chris said. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question. Like, you know, with that, is that a significant cost? How hard is it to schedule? I didn't really get into that area in my column. I know that the residents who are opposed to the gun range, I think they're of the mindset that this is something the police want but don't necessarily need, that it's really not that hard to make, you know, to use the a private gun club to schedule your trainings or whatever. And I mean, that's another issue entirely.
Sure.
Really.
And there are relatively few people that are opposing it. I mean, maybe there are more people opposing it, but I mean, the people that live near there,
right, the people
aren't that
there.
Numerous. But the one was, I mean, it was quite interesting. I mean, you found that this family is trying to go back to farming in that area.
Right. It's a relatively young couple, and they bought that land, sort of that property, with, you know, the idea in mind that they could own horses, they could farm there. They already do have some chickens near that property line with the landfill. So, I mean, to them, they made this investment, and this, they see the gun range as kind of jeopardizing what they had hoped for, you know, for that property.
Mm. And one possibility of compromise is maybe the neighbors would accept an indoor gun range, but again, there's the cost. They'd have to build it. The town would have to build the gun range.
You'd have to build it. It would cost more. Could you offset that cost by then letting other groups make use of it and paying a fee? I mean, that was something Chris Ketsley kind of threw out as an idea. You know, it's possible you could go after grants to kind of offset the cost as well. I can say, what Chris Ketsley told me is he's not opposed to looking at the indoor gun range and pursuing grants to do that, but he was quite clear he would build an outdoor range first, and then maybe you would convert it to an indoor range. And that's not gonna satisfy the residents. You know, they're kind of like indoor range or nothing else, but they wouldn't be satisfied with it will be an outdoor range, then we'll make it an indoor range.
Mm.
You know, that wouldn't make them happy.
Sarah Foss is with us. She is news columnist for the Daily Gazette newspaper. In talking with you about the drunken driving case and the talks given by the woman whose brother was killed by a drunk driver, you mentioned how she's now working with students up at the community college. And you did a column that more mental health resources are needed in schools in New York State, and you referenced, I mean, a number of local incidents, but we did have a police standoff in Rotterdam not too long ago.
Right, yeah, I mean, well, there were two things. I mean, one is I think we just need more mental health resources, you know, for everybody, And the second is that there is next year, or really this year, going into effect is a state law that will require schools to include mental health education as part of their curriculum. And I think the groups that have pushed for this mental health education believe that that will help, you know, down the road as students emerge from school with a greater understanding of, you know, what are the symptoms of depression? Where do you go if you need help? That this is now part of school, much, you know, much like you learn certain things in health education, this will just be a mental health piece of it. But, you know, this larger question, I think, which came up when we had some high profile suicides, Anthony Bourdain and then the fashion designer Kate Spade, was, you know, there's always this sort of call a suicide hotline, you know, reach out and get help. And it's kind of like, well, where do people go for help? It's not necessarily easy to just get a therapist appointment or have the money to pay for it. I mean, it's not an easy thing to get this type of assistance. I mean, if you're in crisis and you walk into a hospital emergency room, someone will deal with you. But I mean, in terms of getting the help and support you need before you're at that moment where you're basically being taken to an ER because you might harm yourself, you know, how do we avoid that scenario? How do we avoid the scenario where someone's, you know, having a breakdown and the police are on the scene? I mean, that we've seen a number of times here, and, you know, it's always very unfortunate. I mean, how do we avoid those situations where there is a lot of tension and someone could easily get shot and killed, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we often pay lip service to it. It kind of reminds me of the, you know, the common refrain of thoughts and prayers when there's
a
tragedy.
Yeah, we do pay lip service to it. And I think the intention is good. I mean, suicide hotline, I mean, that could really help someone in a moment of crisis just to reach that person on the phone. But that is not the same thing as like ongoing treatment for a mental illness, something like bipolar disorder, clinical depression. I mean, those are ongoing issues that need long-term attention. And, you know, I read an essay by someone who was just like, I tried to get help once and I really couldn't afford the $75 fee to see a therapist. Yep. I mean, not everybody just has that sitting around in a pile. And these aren't one-time visits. I mean, therapy is supposed to be an ongoing thing. So you are looking at a cost that, you know, it grows over time. You may not always feel like you have that money.
You did a column about a man who has worked very hard to help people. That's a medical doctor, a native of Amsterdam, Dr. Tom Katina. I believe you had talked to him some time back or something like that, but there was a new documentary about him that came out?
Yeah, actually, the documentary is about his work in Sudan, in a mountainous region, taking care of, I mean, it's like thousands of people. He's like the only doctor for this poor, remote region. I didn't talk to him. I emailed him some questions, which, because he's in Sudan, that was an easier way to get answers than, you know, a long distance call. So he replied to me. So yes, he's the subject of a new documentary played at Proctor's called The Heart of Nuba. And it's gotten, you know, good reviews. I wasn't able to see it, but I mean, what I heard is that it's an outstanding look at, you know, his humanitarian work, which he's been doing for a long time. And I, you know, he seemed like a humble guy in our exchange, but this is a smart guy. He went to Brown University, which is an Ivy League school, and he's a doctor. And I think he felt called by God, really, to go to this area and do this out of a sense of mission to serve. And he's, you know, in his responses to my questions, he was quite clear that this is something, you know, he does out of a sense of religious, I think specifically Catholic conviction.
Yeah, I mean, I know he's very much revered in my hometown of Amsterdam, and he could have done other things. I mean, he went to Brown, you know, he could have been a real rich doctor somewhere. But
yeah, he didn't just end up in this area because he couldn't make it in America. I mean, he went there because this was what he felt he wanted to do. You're right. He could be here probably making a ton of money as a doctor. Instead, he's gone to this poor area. He's in a practice that, you know, it sounds like they rely almost exclusively on donations to keep going.
Did he say why he ended up in Sudan specifically?
That's a good question. No, he didn't. I'm trying to think if he said that. No, yeah, why Sudan? Was it just a need, or did someone invite him to go there? Because, I mean, in addition to being poor, it's also quite dangerous, I think. Yeah.
You've been listening to Talk of the Town on Magic 590 and 100.5. I'm Bob Cudmore. Our guest today, Sarah Foss, news columnist for The Daily Gazette. The program will be available as a podcast on albanymagic.com and bobcudmore.com. Next Sunday's guest on Talk of the Town will be Niskayuna Town Supervisor Yasmin Syed. I'm Bob Cudmore.